Hey Arizona, welcome to episode 19. I'm your host Matt Morales, and we have a great show for you today. At the bottom of the hour, we have Robbie Sherwood of Progress Now coming into the studio with Barrett and myself to talk about the news of the week. In our spotlight, Senator Anna Tovar sits down with Daniela Yalos to talk about her life and her path to the Capitol. But right now, I move it over to the studio to Barrett, who's sitting down with the Journalist Roundtable. This is Copper Talk.
Welcome to another edition of Copper Talk. I'm your host, Barrett Marson. Today I'm with Gary Grotto and Jim Small, both from the award-winning Capital Times. Gentlemen, good morning.
Good morning. You sounded disappointed when you introduced us, though.
Well, I always am disappointed when I introduce you guys. I don't have a beer in front of me, and I got to talk to you guys. Gentlemen, today we're going to talk a little Common Core. I know everybody's excited about hearing about Common Core. So, Gary, you covered some of the happenings, and this week there was a Senate vote on eliminating Common Core. So tell me what happened with that.
Yeah, well, the Senate killed it. Five Republicans joined the Democrats to kill it. And
what would the bill have done?
The bill would have prohibited the state from adopting Common Core standards and using the PARC test, the assessment that would go along with it, or you know, any other test like that.
Yeah, and you know, this is obviously, it would have kind of put the state in a weird position, because the State Board of Education adopted Common Core standards in 2010. I mean, this says you can't use those standards, so that means, what we go to the argument from the business community was, wait a second, if you say you can't use those standards, then we have no standards, and where do we go from here? We're gonna have to start all over again, or are we gonna have to do we want to revert back to the standards we had before, which everyone pretty much universally agrees the standards may have been okay. Certainly the implementation and the testing for those standards was abysmal. I mean, as viewed, as we saw over a decade in the whole Ames debacle, where the test kept getting watered down and watered down and watered down. You know, so it was really kind of a question as to where do you go? And you saw these pro-business Republicans basically all of them were folks who at one point or another supported the Medicaid expansion. So you kind of, again, had that coalition of business-oriented Republicans versus ideological Republicans.
You know, we've seen the business community exert itself a lot over the last couple of weeks. Is this going to be a new trend, do you think, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the business community is really engaged. You know, we've heard this from time to time over the past several election cycles, that the business community we're really going to step up and we're going to be more involved. And they have to a certain degree. I mean, we've seen some spending and choosing who to endorse, but I think they really feel reinvigorated. I mean, I think you've got a combination of issues that are very important to them. I mean, whether it's Common Core, whether it's the Medicaid expansion, and you throw in the fact that now they've got new contribution limits, so they're getting some of their electoral power back. Their ability to play on the campaign trail is coming back. You've got they can go out and spend money through nonprofits and IE groups. Clean Elections has been in a lot of ways really kind of nerfed. And it's a lot less powerful than it was. And so I think that they see a real opportunity to start turning things back in their favor, whereas, you know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, they were shifting the other way.
And Gary, why were so many Republicans against Common Core?
Well, there's an organized effort to get rid of it. You know, some people say it's a Tea Party, and there's other ideas of where this comes from. Of course, they say that it's, I think the biggest fear is that because, you know, the Obama administration had embraced these standards early on and used incentives to get states to adopt them, that, you know, this is going to become the federalization of education.
And I know, Barrett, you kind of dismissed the idea, you know, as not being very exciting or something no one wants to talk about. But I got news for you. You're going to be hearing a lot about this between now and August, because this is going to be one of the bigger issues on the campaign trail in Republican primaries this year. It's going to be this fight over Common Core. And it's going to be, this may be a litmus test, the same way that we saw 1070 support be a litmus test in the past. Things like that, where people are going to go out there and say, my opponent supports Common Core. And that's going to be an epithet in a lot of Republican primaries this year.
Jim, I can't wait. And now, Jim, let's talk a little bit about a new poll released this week from a national outfit discussing the Arizona 2014 gubernatorial race. How did that poll look?
Yeah, so a little bit of background. Public policy polling, Democratic polling firm. They polled in the Republican primary, polled about 400 registered voters statewide. In for the general election, they polled about 870 or so. Essentially, what it found, a couple things. One, the general election, Doug Ducey fares competitively against the Republican candidates. I think he was trailing two of them, trailing Bennett and Smith, and he was in a dead heat with Ducey and slightly ahead of, you know, Jones and Andrew Thomas and some of the other folks. The lower tier Republicans, I think he was beating more comfortably. So it tells us that we know, at the very least right now in February, 9 months before this election, it looks like Fred Duvall is at least in position to be a competitive candidate for the Democrats. On the Republican primary, the poll showed us a lot of what we knew before, you know, that Ken Bennett still has an early lead on paper. You know, he's followed by, you know, Scott Smith is doing well. He's got a reputation. He's only been in the race for about 2 months, but he's certainly got a reputation and got some support among Republican voters. And then you have a lot of people who you know, kind of show up further down that list, including Doug Ducey, you know, and Andrew Thomas and you know, a bunch of people with 1%, and you still have at least a third of the electorate that doesn't know who they're going to vote for, because we still haven't had anyone spending any money really to go out and connect with voters.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, no one has spent money, and so I think it is kind of early to tell if there was a true front runner. But one thing I'll say is Christine Jones, who hasn't spent any money on any outside campaign activities, is number two. 16%, if I wasn't mistaken. That to me is a little impressive, considering, you know, she hasn't done much of anything publicly.
Yeah, and by far, you know, I think we've had about 5 or 6 polls done over the past year and a half in this race, and that's the highest she's shown up in any of these polls, without a doubt. You know, she's obviously going to benefit from being the only woman in the race. We don't know yet how much, you know, how much is that going to be worth. When you kind of looked at the breakdown of her polls, she actually had more support from men than women, but she also had, among the candidates, she had the most support among women. So, you know, it was an interesting breakdown for her. So it'd be curious to see how her status as the only female candidate affects, you know, I think the common perception is, oh, well, women are going to vote for her. But I think that applies to some men as well, that they view, you know, there's some kind of belief that maybe a woman candidate is the right person to have.
And finally, what did the poll say specifically about Doug Ducey, state treasurer?
I want to say he was in fifth place in the poll, about 6% in the poll right now, which is honestly about where he's been in every other poll. You know, we went back and looked at the other polls, and he was generally in that 5 points to maybe 8 or 9 points range. And you know, it still gets the fact that he's got the most money right now in the race. He probably has more money right now than Ken Bennett, who's the nominal leader in these polls, than Ken Bennett's going to get the entire campaign because he's running clean elections. So at some point, these numbers are going to start fluctuating rapidly because everyone's going to start spending money. Doug Ducey will spend money. Scott Smith will spend money. Christine Jones will. And then Ken Bennett will get his money and he'll start spending it. And so, you know, these things are going to be in flux a lot right now. So we've still got a long way to go here. But we are drawing pretty quickly into this kind of the heat of the campaign season. I mean, we've got less than 5 months till early ballots go out. And, you know, that's, you know, the end of July is when that happens. And so people are going to have to start spending, you know, some serious money and really starting to hit the campaign trail in earnest here, I think, in the next couple months.
Okay. All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Have a great day. And we'll be back with an interview with Senate Minority Leader Anna Tovar right after this.
This is Tom Spratt. If you want to know what's really going on at the state capitol, subscribe to Arizona Capital Times and azcapitaltimes.com. Call 602-258-7026 or visit azcapitaltimes.com.
Thank you for tuning in to Copper Talk. This is Daniela Yalos, and joining me in the studio is Senate Minority Leader Anna Tovar. Senator Tovar, thank you so much for being on our Spotlight On segment this week.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Senator, you've spent your whole life in the West Valley. How has the West Side changed since you were a child?
Wow, it has changed dramatically. And let me tell you, when I was a young girl, I remember my grandfather taking me to what is now I-10. As I remember the I-10 ending on Dysart Road. So in growing up, he would take me and we would see like the earth movers and digging up and what is now, you know, the I-10 freeway. But I remember him clear as day, you know, telling me like, you know, mija, one day, you know, this is going to be a huge freeway and millions of people will come through here. And, you know, the city is not going to be what it used to be in the West Valley. And, you know, we're going to have things here that you probably just couldn't imagine and people coming here that wouldn't otherwise come here. And thinking, you know, on that now, you know, thinking, you know, now that the Super Bowl was there, there's a stadium. I mean, there's so many things out in the West Valley. Truly, for me, you know, for many others, it was a hidden gem in Arizona. But I still feel it is a gem, but it is growing into a vibrant diamond.
And your family owned a grocery store, is that right?
Yes, yes. I had a very unique upbringing. So my grandparents were migrant workers, so they immigrated from Mexico and, you know, worked the fields in Oregon, Washington, California, and Arizona. And my grandfather had the idea of it first started off his idea of selling fruit and sandwiches to the workers while he was working. And then from there, it grew into a fruit stand, a sandwich stand on the side of the road. From there, it grew into a small, you know, tiny grocery store. And from there, it was, you know, the grocery store that I knew and grew up in. Since I was 4 days old, my mom operated the store. So she had went to the eighth grade. And after that, my grandparents said, you know, you need to stay here and help run the store. So my uncle and my mom, along with my grandparents, operated the store. It was for over 50 years. So, you know, I grew up, I knew nothing else but life at the store. So it was pretty unique. So by the time I went to kindergarten, I knew all my numbers and I knew how to count coins. And a funny story is, so my grandfather would, in order for us to get onto the cash register at the store, like he would come to us and buy stuff and we would have to add things on our head, and he would pay for the $100 and he would say, okay, give me my change back, and we had to count it back to him. So it was pretty unique. So I was able to do that by the age of five of going into kindergarten. Mm.
And Senator, you were a teacher for 5 years. What did you learn from being a teacher?
Wow, I definitely learned so much being a school teacher. I grew up in the small town of Tolleson in the West Valley and had instrumental and mentoring teachers that influenced me to be a teacher. So along with my upbringing at the store and with great community members, I learned that there's so many people that help you along the way. And for me, it was just natural to have that inclination to give back to my community. So when I went through college, I applied at one school, and that was the school I attended. And that was what is now called PH Gonzalez out in Tolleson. And the great thing about it is when my first year of teaching, I actually taught with teachers that taught me. So it was pretty neat to be a, you know, have colleagues that once taught you, and now, you know, to have been able to work hand in hand with them. It was just something that was a blessing. And, you know, what I learned from teaching itself is, you know, I was there to, you know, mold lives and change children by giving them and helping them learn how to read. But I think beyond that, they taught me quite a bit more. They taught me, you know, to be patient, to be passionate, and to never give up on them.
Senator, at that same time, a very serious thing happened. You were diagnosed with leukemia. Please tell us about that.
Yes, that was in my fifth year of teaching, where I was teaching my kindergarten class. It's about 5 weeks into the new year, where I noticed I had this really bad bruise and just was, I look back now and I was just very tired, but it was typical of a teacher, you know, new school year, you're running yourself, you know, 15-hour days and you're exhausted. So I didn't think it was, you know, anything then. I just thought I was tired because I was working long hours. But at the persistence of my husband, he insisted that I go to our family doctor, and I did, you know, and just took what I thought would be routine blood tests. But, you know, the next day he called me in my classroom and asked me to go to the doctor's office, and he needed to go over some test results from the blood that he took the day previous. So I knew it was something serious, but never to the extent of being diagnosed with cancer. So that same day he sent me to an oncologist, where I proceeded to have a bone marrow biopsy. And 5 days later, I would say probably the longest 5 days of my life, we're awaiting the test results. And when the test results came in, you know, I was, my husband and I were in the office, the doctor's office, where my, you know, doctor that I've known for over a decade, you know, explained to my husband that, you know, that I had leukemia. So it was, you know, one of those moments in your life where, as people say, you know, a ton of bricks and the world kind of becomes silent and everything stops. So that I experienced. And I think probably the hardest part of that day was knowing that I had to stop teaching immediately. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things I would say was most hurtful and painful, because that was my passion. And I truly thought that I was going to be a school teacher for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I would say the other first question out of my mouth when I asked, when I was diagnosed, was, is this something that I was, that I could pass on, mm-hmm. hereditary to my two children? And luckily it wasn't. It wasn't something that was hereditary. But again, it was, to me, just the most shocking thing that can happen to a person.
Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry we don't have tissues in here.
That's okay.
So that obviously had a very significant impact in your life. Is that where you decided to go into public office, or how did things shift from there?
Actually, I was in politics already. That same year, so I was diagnosed in August. I ran for city council in that year, so I was just sworn into office in July. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, how am I going to be able to do this, you know, if I'm diagnosed with cancer? And for sure, they're going to ask me to step down. But just the opposite happened. They asked me to stay on. They allowed me to vote by phone when I was getting my treatment. And, you know, I had nothing but time on my hands, you know, in, I would call it my little bubble of a room, because it was, I was secluded in a room where I would have very minimal contact with people. Like, for example, my first day at the hospital, I was in for about 46 days, and 44 of those days, I wasn't able to touch my children or hug them. So mm-hmm. that was very difficult. We actually corresponded. My husband would video record the kids, and we would send messages. Back mm-hmm. then, you know, with just recordings, like a video recording, so, or talk to them on the phone. But at that time, they were very, very young. I mean, 2 and 5. So, I mean, it was a shock to not only my whole family, but I think more so my kids. Mm-hmm.
And from looking at you, it's hard to believe you've been married almost 20 years, right?
Yeah, it is. It's gone by so fast. And I keep dropping hints to my husband, like, hello, our 20th anniversary. Like, wow, we should plan something big. And he's like, oh, yeah. But I met my husband. And we were high school sweethearts. So actually, I met him. What I had set my brother up on a blind date with my friend's cousin, and we went to the movies. And my best friend and I had to take, had to escort my brother and her cousin because they didn't want to go alone. So we went and tagged along, and we went and watched a free movie and had a dinner. So at the movie theater is when I first saw my husband. I saw him at the popcorn stand getting popcorn, and I saw him, and for me, it was love at first sight. Like, ooh, I want to get to know, you know, meet him. And so after the movie is when we ran into each other, and I had sworn, like, if I see this guy again, I'm going to give him my number. So I gave him my number, and we sent letters to each other for like 6 to 8 months. Because at that time, he had spent the summer with his uncle in California. And so we would just write each other by letters, you know, for the first 6 months, and then started dating, and then, you know, we've been together ever since.
And you have two children together.
Yeah, two boys. And, you know, it was always when I was, you know, when we were dating and had children at a very young age, when I would say very young age, in my very early 20s, I'd always ask myself, like, wow, you know, we met, we got married, you know, we had kids at a very young age. Mm-hmm. But when we were hit with the news of cancer, it kind of fell into place where you're like, oh, now I know why things happen. Because that was one of the other things when I was going through treatment of cancer. They had said, you know, this the chemo and the whole process is very intense on your body. So, mm-hmm. you know, you won't be able to have children. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I've been blessed with two. And now mm-hmm. I know the reason why I met my husband at such a young age and had children at a very young age, but mm-hmm. definitely am blessed with now two teenage boys.
And how have you been able to balance your political career with your familial responsibilities? I mean, after the city council, you went on to become the vice mayor, and then you went to the House of Representatives, and now you're the minority leader in the Arizona State Senate. How have you been able to balance everything and also keep up with your health?
Well, I would say it's definitely a jungle, just a juggling act, and making sure that my priority is always my family first. I mean, I wouldn't be able to be where I am today, you know, going through the journey of cancer, being able to serve as a public servant without my family. They've been there since, you know, day one, encouraging me to become the vice mayor, to take that next step, to be state rep, and to play an active role in leadership as well. So they've been there for me, so, you know, they can watch the boys and take them to practice. And, you know, my husband as well, he's a great cook during session time. But I would say that my kids do get tired of barbecues because I can leave things and he will barbecue anything. But right about now, my kids are like, I don't want barbecue anymore. Can Dad cook something else? But Dad's good at barbecue.
And, of course, being a Latina is a very important part of who you are. You are co-chair of the Arizona Latino Caucus. What are the caucus's priorities, and where are you in terms of progress?
Well, this year we're excited that the Latino Caucus is right now at 26 members, so which is great. And, you know, being chair of the Latino Caucus this year, we are tackling issues that are important to all Arizona families. CPS was our first initial meeting, and where we had our first meeting of the session was in regards to CPS. We also joined the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in laying out our priorities for our Latino Caucus. So, you know, we've taken a very active role. The caucus is open to any member, so it is a bipartisan. And as of 2 weeks ago, we had our first Republican join, T.J. Shope. So it's great to know that, you know, we're pushing for issues and priorities that are important to our Latino families and children. But again, essentially, these priorities are for, you know, all Arizonans.
And as we wrap up, Senator, what is your next big goal, either personally or professionally?
Wow. Well, I think I'm establishing my weight and keeping that under control. I think that was a big issue because, you know, when you start session, and any legislator can testify to this, like, there's so much food and you're eating so many bad things that you're it's easy to gain the weight. So I'm like determined not to gain my legislative weight back on. It took a long time to get it off. So I'm going to be working on that as well. But I think just on my goal, just for my family, is for us to be healthy and happy. As for opportunities that come my way, as you know, in career wise, one thing I learned in battling, you know, through cancer and going through the journey is, you need to be open to opportunities to present themselves to you. So that's one thing I've learned, is being open to different opportunities that might present themselves. And also, one of the other things I learned is kind of that fear of failure is gone. I think that was one thing that has changed me since before my transplant and going through the journey, and now after, is I would always talk myself out of things, or say, you know, I wasn't ready for them, or, you know, just as women, I think we do this naturally on why we can't do something. We always talk ourselves out of it. But I would say since the journey of battling cancer, is that fear is gone now. For me, it's like if an opportunity presents itself, I'll jump right into it and figure, you know, what's the worst thing can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, no, I won't either get that appointment or go for that next step in office, but definitely have my options open. I truly do want to continue serving the constituents of this great state of Arizona. So looking forward to see what opportunities present themselves.
Thank you so much for joining us on Copper Talk, Senator Tovar. This has been Spotlight on Senate Minority Leader Anna Tovar.
So Daniela, you have an announcement for us?
I do. This will be my last Copper Talk show. I have accepted a position as executive director of a statewide nonprofit organization, and I want to dedicate my attention on this new endeavor. But I do want to say, Matt, that it's been a great experience creating Copper Talk with you guys, getting together to discuss the latest Arizona political happenings and seeing the number of listeners rise each passing week. It's really been fantastic. I look forward to hearing the podcast and seeing where you guys take Copper Talk as you continue. And to our listeners, I do want to say thank you so much for tuning in each week. I know these guys will continue to entertain and inform you.
Thank you so much, Danielle. And it's been wonderful having you with us this whole time.
Thank you.
Good luck in your new endeavors.
Thanks.
This is Jim Small, editor of Arizona News Service. If you want to know the news before it happens and get the real story behind the story, read the Yellow Sheet Report today. To subscribe, visit yellowsheetreport.com.
Welcome to Put an Egg on It with Robbie Sherwood. Today, our guest in studio is Robbie Sherwood, and I'm your host, Barrett Marson. Today, we're going to talk about some exciting political developments this week. Robbie, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing? Good to be here.
I see on Facebook, like, every week you put an egg on something different.
Yeah,
sometimes it's good, sometimes not so much.
Yeah, a little context. That's my imaginary Food Network show, Put an Egg on It with Robbie Sherwood. It exists only on Facebook. My day job is Progress Now Arizona.
And so in this segment, we're going to talk a little bit about SB 1062, which was vetoed by the governor last week. And we're going to talk a little bit about the fallout, if there is long-term fallout for both Republicans and Democrats and the state in general.
If I have anything to do with it, there will be.
But, you know, Robbie, first of all, the bill was vetoed by a Republican governor. Several Republicans came out and said the governor should veto this, even some who voted for it. But clearly this was a time for the business community to stand up and make itself known, and they did.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of lobbying to the business community, better late than never. They didn't say a word while it was on the floor and being debated, where they might have headed it off at the pass and perhaps saved the state a massive level of embarrassment, but they do deserve credit for coalescing and very strongly urging the governor to veto it. But that doesn't mean there won't be electoral consequences potentially for state legislators who voted for it or impacts on statewide races because of voters who are now active and paying attention to an election that they might not have been a participant in upcoming. So,
you know, Robbie, I know, you know, one of your goals at Progress Now is to bring out the vote, not just to convince people to vote Democrat, but also just to bring voters out. And I think we hear this almost every single election where somebody says, well, this is a reason for a lot of people to come out and vote, and it doesn't happen. We always hear about the Hispanic community has reason to come out and vote, and they still don't.
That's not true that they don't.
They don't in the numbers that other groups do.
But for a few other factors, Richard Carmona would be your senator because of the rising Latino vote. You know, it was a presidential election, but he got within 3 points. But for a third-party candidate, Sheriff Joe Arpaio will be an ex-sheriff. So you now have 3 Latino members of the City Council of Phoenix and a progressive mayor. And I think that you can largely attribute that to the rising Latino vote. So there's a demographic called the rising American electorate. It's ethnic minorities, single women, and voters under 30. Excuse me. And there are 900,000 people in this demographic in Arizona that are registered to vote. And when they do vote, they tend to vote largely Democratic in high numbers. They turn out in presidential elections. They don't turn out in high numbers in midterm elections. And it's not because they're lazy. It's not because of anything like that. It's mostly, I think, my personal theory is because people in that demographic, they're maybe new to the process, and they don't know what's at stake for them in an election like a midterm, a state legislature, congressional election, because they don't know who those people are. Turns out there's a lot at stake for them. So an issue like 1062 politicized maybe for the first time a lot of people in that one key element of that rising American electorate, the voters under 30. There were a lot of young people at those rallies tuning into this debate who maybe for the first time are now aware of what this legislature is up to and how it impacts their lives. And so they became political on this. And so I think they're going to be paying attention in November and turning out for an election that they otherwise would not have participated in. Mm-hmm. And that's bad news for Republicans.
You know, you bring up Carmona, the Flake-Carmona race. Yet, I mean, Flake, a suburban, conservative, white Republican, still handily won. I mean, it was closer than, say, McCain-Glassman, but still, you know, the election wasn't in doubt.
It certainly wasn't.
I don't think I disagree. I know it was a couple days until Carmona conceded, but there was never a time when it didn't look like Jeff Flake was going to win. I
think that's from revision history. I think there were some polls where Carmona was very much in it.
Oh, I'm not saying
what a lot of resources came to a lot of Flake's aid.
No, I agree. There was a lot of resources.
Where are you going with it? What's the point?
My point is that this is still a Republican state, and it's still dominated by the suburban voter who comes out to vote.
Yeah, well, not for long. So Arizona demographically is undergoing some shifts. And it is the largest state with the highest number of electoral votes, 11, of any state in the union outside of Texas that has the potential to turn purple to blue on its own, even if you did nothing, because of the number of Latinos and the rise of that population. Now, that's like 10, 15, you know, perhaps even 20 years away. Mm-hmm. What organizations I work with are trying to accelerate that process, activate those voters, and turn them out. I think Arizona has a real potential to turn out for a Democratic presidential candidate in 2016, and to make some serious noise in the next election.
Yeah. So, well, let's move to a place where Latinos.
Stop laughing, man.
Where they vote, where they're the majority in the district. Arizona Congressional District 7, Ed Pastor announced recently that he's retiring after 20-odd years in the House. and a slew of people have come out. Everyone from Mary Rose Wilcox to Steve Gallardo to Ruben Gallego to Jarrett Maupin even. And there is the...
Potentially a couple of others.
Potentially, yeah. I think, you know, you could see a 10-person primary before it's all done.
CD7 is a majority-minority district. It's upwards of 70-75% Latino district. That doesn't mean that the representative from that district has to be Latino. What it means is, in the redistricting process and the district drawing process, that district was drawn to create the highest statistical likelihood that the Latino community elects someone that they support, a Latino candidate. And that's what you had in Ed Pastor. He was the first. You know, this is not like we're harkening back to the civil rights era of 1964. He was elected in the 90s, and he was the first. And so there's a legacy there, and to come in and change that is something that you have to consider the dynamics, and it's going to create a reaction, a strong reaction within that community. And as a progressive person and someone with, I honestly do not have a dog in that fight. I'm from Mesa. I love everybody. But that is going to be a very disruptive thing, and if you have larger goals for progressives and for the state, to turn the state blue, to me, that, you know, on a lot of levels, that probably doesn't help. A fight along those battle lines doesn't help. Mm-hmm. In some ways it does, though. A robust election and a primary in CD7, which has some of the lowest turnout, not just in the state, but in the nation, and suddenly people are getting activated and turning out in there, that helps somebody like a Fred Duvall off on the side. You know, maybe, you know, 20,000-30,000 voters that turn out in an election, and, you know, for the primary, but then you can turn them out in the general because they've already voted once.
Right.
You know, that could close the performance gap for someone like Fred, who polls show is only 1 or 2 points behind most of his field, if not ahead of some of them.
Should we take a minute and talk about Republican chances in CD7? I think that's enough time for today. So, Robbie, thanks
Snowball
a lot.
Hell.
Robbie, thanks a lot for coming in. Appreciate it. Everyone have a great week.
Yeah.